Hello and welcome to a special podcast. We are going to interview the founder and CEO of asset management firm Vesta, Mr. Paul Fromm. Paul, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to see you, Sarah.
Thank you. And the subject we're going to talk about is the National Health Insurance Bill. I really wanted to talk to you because I watched the two business blunders in which you dealt with NHI, and it was, in a perverse way for me, a pleasure to see someone get angry about it, because we think people should be angry about it. We are fed the idea that there's going to be free healthcare for all, and by all they mean 58 million people. So that includes the existing public sector and the existing private sector. That there will be an increase in our taxes, but all the money will go into a single fund, and it is through this fund that will be centrally administered by the government that such services will be provided. Our concern, and I'd like to see your view on it, is that this is not a practical way of resolving the crises in healthcare. It's an ideological position on the part of the government. So briefly, what do you see as the real problems of the major problems with NHI, and why it is unlikely to succeed?
Yeah, for starters, I think it is definitely going to fail. The question is, how is it going to fail? No, you're absolutely right. It's been prompted, I guess, by the ANC government's desire to introduce world-class levels of universal healthcare. I mean, it is a trend globally. We see this in many countries, ranging from those that can actually afford it and where they don't have significant corruption, you know, places like Scandinavia and Canada, right through to other developing countries where people are tinkering away. But look, I think there's a philosophical departure point problem here. What we have in this country is very bad universal healthcare. Any citizen of the country, plus any visitor for that matter, can walk into one of our public health facilities and obtain healthcare. The quality of that service varies greatly depending on where you are. If you're in George in the Western Cape, you have a good chance of getting relatively good care and getting out of there alive. You may also have a reasonable experience of Groote Schuur in Cape Town. Where you will not do well is in a rural hospital in Limpopo, or even in an urban hospital in Mpumalanga or the Free State, for that matter. We know that the government public sector health system consumes nearly 13% of South Africa's total tax take. That's an amount of something in the region of 230 or 250 billion rand, so big money. But a lot of it gets wasted because of poor administration, maladministration, demotivated staff, etc., etc. Also, we know that an increasingly large portion of that money is going to medical malpractice payouts already being deployed in the public sector.
I think it's a quarter of the budget goes to negligence.
Quarter of the existing healthcare budget. And rising, I'm sorry to say.
I mean, perhaps the example that we read about over the weekend was that appalling case of a newborn baby being put into, I suppose, a sort of a warmer, which was used to warm very small babies up. But the nurses had left the warmer on to the extent that the child was badly burnt and eventually died of its injuries. The particular irony to this horror story is that the hospital sent the mother and the child to a private facility to try and be saved. And the level of mismanagement, neglect, incompetence, whatever it may be, is this going to be solved by the NHI? Is it not money problem?
Because, you know, with haphazard management, it's an easy target for medical malpractice suits. So the problem, I'm afraid, is that whereas that clearly needs to be improved, the government's attention for some reason has been directed on wealthy people who take their own savings, put those into medical aid schemes, and the medical aid schemes then on their behalf provide high level of private sector care. So this is the problem. It's not that we have nothing going on. It's not that there aren't some isolated pockets of excellence, in fact, in the public sector. It's that the socialist bent of our national government has turned towards the idea that somehow we must grab the money from the private sector and slurp that into the fund, which is obviously going to be an absolute boondoggle, which is absolutely and obviously going to devolve into a financial mess, because there are no honest, intelligent, clever cadres out there to run these things, because if they were any such people, they would have... No, they're not money problems. And you know what? If the government was really concerned about health outcomes, what they would do is that they would contract with Discovery and Netcare, as an example, to take over the management and financial administration of, you know, Johannesburg General, now called Charlotte Maxeke Hospital. They would do that because they would be concerned about the citizenry. But they do not. They do not, because there is a whole hierarchy of individuals and bureaucrats in the Gauteng provincial administration, the people who brought us Life Esidimeni, whose job it is to shovel money around and to shuffle about. There is a massive Nehawu and other healthcare union presence in these organizations that the government's very scared of. So as a consequence, one cannot really be very hopeful. So I think what's happening here really is that the ANC at a number of different policy conferences under the Zuma era and beyond into the present has called for a national health initiative because they somehow think this is the solution to the government's problems in that arena politically. So they're going to pass the act. It's going to get resisted in Parliament by the DA because it doesn't want to see a watering down of the provincial powers in the Western Cape. It's going to chunder forward. It's going to then bring into being this NHI, which will at first instance take the national appropriations, and it will also then probably grab the medical aid deductions and shovel those in there too, so there'll be a bit more money. Then we will go into some kind of purgatory where the plan is to, you know, somehow evolve to something new, but we'll get stuck. The problem is we can't sit here as South African citizens and allow this thing to perpetuate, because unfortunately it's going to cause medical practitioners to want to leave the country. It's going to cause severe disruption in the medical aid industry, where people wonder whether it's worth still belonging to a Discovery or a Med Scheme or a Bonitas or whatever. And that's a worry, because then we could lose our top level medical practitioners in this country. So I don't really know, and that's why I'm very angry about the fact that there's been such a weak response from the medical aid industry and from the hospitals, because they seem so scared that they're going to fall foul of their regulators that they've been reluctant to speak out for their customers, which I think they really should be doing more.
That's worried me quite a lot. It's worried me because there's a sort of maxim that the industry goes by, which is don't bet on the other guy's pitch. And this is what the government does usually, is it puts out a piece of draft legislation which causes anger, confusion and frustration. And the lobby groups, the interested parties, then make a whole lot of recommendations and it gets watered down to something that the ANC is happy to live with. We're concerned that actually that's the point that they wanted to be at anyway. And so instead of them saying, go back to the drawing board, this is terrible and won't work for the following reasons, we end up with a sort of half-hearted version that suits the answer, that doesn't suit the society.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the scenario you're talking about. One of the other things that I'll come on to the big players is there's the government creates a misperception that somehow whites are the major beneficiaries of medical aids, and they put out percentages and figures that no one can track, no one can see the research for, and private research by reputable people have shown that in fact Africans are the largest number of
quite
medical
right.
aid beneficiaries, then whites, then Asians, then coloureds and Asians. In other words, the situation is changing as it largely should. Nothing ever works in exact numbers, and adhering to the national demographic is a bizarre concept at the best of times. But it's that absolute misinformation that tries to create a illusion that something, a situation is, but it isn't actually.
No, you're right. We see that in lots of different areas of policy, employment policy, schooling, private security, all sorts of areas where, in fact, the reality doesn't match that kind of white monopoly capital perspective that likes to get shopped around. Yes, I think what is interesting for me is that the ANC also pushes it ideologically to the breaking point. So it's fine to say we're going to try better in the public sector, and we're going to try and create a competitive environment where the public services are so good that, you know, middle-income people will want to use them. But they don't do that. They jump straight from the present reality into some sort of socialist nirvana where a single-payer medical system would be desirable. So in other words, they bypass all sorts of middle-income, middle-country type solutions which make sense, and they leap for the one that makes the least sense, which is like for the most evolved society, as though that was what we were. It also is a approach to policy which somehow, notwithstanding the evidence, seems to ignore the idea of regulatory failure and administrative failure and the crippling effects of corruption and mismanagement.
There's an irony that my sense of the bill is that the one layer that is primarily responsible for health, or is primarily responsible for health, which is provincial, is almost ignored in the sense that national government will handle it centrally and the provinces will just come back to do it.
Yes, and then there'll be these district bodies that will handle it. Yes. Like, where the hell is that going to come from? We know what happens at the district level, where failing municipalities fail even more frequently because there's confusion about which little town falls into which little district. And there's a fellow with a Mercedes who sort of shuttles between the two or four metropoles or larger towns, and nobody is ever quite sure who's supposed to do anything.
There seems to be a sort of disconnect between distinctly ideology, socialist, despite all evidence to the contrary that ever working, and the desire to create something that meets the ideology but is likely to be highly unsuccessful. I mean, I cannot see, given the Yesterday Mainings and the Bird Baby scenarios that we become unfortunately used to see at provincial level, I don't see a centralized level anywhere near handling it any better.
Absolutely, and I fear that what might happen is that giant sums of money might start flowing into these things, particularly if they enforce payroll taxes, which is part of the plan. You know, I mean, there are already payroll taxes. There are skills development levy funds. And if you speak to any corporate, big or small, the money that goes into the skills development levy funds never comes out because no one ever accesses those funds because it's almost impossible to conceive of a training program or an employment stimulation program which meets their criteria. So those organizations basically grab all that money, slosh it around. It largely gets used on self-fulfilling, you know, projects inside those organizations. So that's the concern, is that we may end up with double taxes in effect. In other words, the medical aid discretionary feedback stuff will go, I'm not using the right word at this particular moment, you know, the deductions, that's the word with the D I was looking for. And then what will happen is there'll be the introduction of some kind of payroll tax and maybe even surcharges. But it's not going to work. I mean, that money, if it goes in, will end up, you know, just sort of filtering into the existing public system. So this is where it comes to the question of what is the correct mode of resistance. I think right-thinking individuals must follow this constitutional challenge by the provinces closely and see what can be done to help there. We must also look amongst the medical service provider industry, whether it's the hospital groups or individual groups of physicians or of you know, medical specialists of some ilk, or even the physiotherapists or someone, anyone who is prepared to take this thing on an early basis, on the idea that it is unconstitutional to force anyone to practice within and for the state. So that must be pushed back, the idea that any medical practitioner has to be NHI contracted in. And then we must also look to the medical aid industry and see if there's anyone who's prepared to stand up and be counted. I can understand that the likes of, say, MedScheme and Discovery somehow think that if the NHI is implemented, there will be a big, juicy contract to administer 50 7 million lives on an outsourced basis for the government. And so they don't want to be seen to be fighting now. But there may be someone else in the industry who recognizes they're not going to get that deal and is prepared to stand up for their members now. Because the medical aids, remember, are bodies which belong to their members. Somebody has a contract to administer the scheme, but they don't own the reserves and they don't own the cash flows from the premiums. So someone must stand up and say, you know what, that's nonsense. We want to contract with our members, and this is what our members want. They don't want to be part of your NHI. They don't want to follow your pathways. They don't want to go to your district meetings. They don't want anything to do with you. They want their current private benefits based on their current private savings. And then we must see whether they can't launch some kind of constitutional challenge early on. Because let's look at some of the disastrous ideas we've had out of the government in recent years. Zuma's nuclear power stations. That thing got headed off because somebody had the guts to go to court early and kill them on the consultation process. The ETOLs also got killed early on. You know, the Kucha power, not Kucha, the Kucha oil refinery. Remember that boondoggle? What we don't want is a situation where this thing becomes like the skills development levies, which gets implemented in form only, which takes all the money but results in no benefits. And we must also constantly be looking for ways to push back against the idea that our existing medical aid savings and private providers are going to be restricted in terms of their ability to practice. So this idea that in 2026 or whenever it is that medical aids may only provide complementary services, that must get pushed back so that the complementary services are everything. And I think that's the locus of the fight.
I get the impression, tell me if you think I'm wrong, that one of the problems with the big companies, particularly involved in the medical aid or pharmaceutical business, is there's almost, I can understand the potentially lucrative contract, but the problem's based on historical political experience. One is, maybe there won't be those contracts, if they're nowhere near the private sector. And theoretically, in terms of the ideology, can't.
They've said as much, yeah.
And the other thing is that they're very likely not going to be paid. Anyone who's dealt with the public sector, and particularly the hospital, the health sector, people have gone out of business
waiting to get paid. And it's well known that you have to bribe somebody in the payment chain in order to get paid effectively, is how that works.
The other thing is there does seem to be the medical aid members just, they don't seem to be of concern to the medical aids. It's not, you don't get the feeling that they really canvass the members.
Yeah, they're sort of taking them for granted. They sort of feel that, like, well, they'll always be there and they'll never leave. Because I think medium-sized companies run by feisty, you know, South African entrepreneurs will say, screw it, I have to pay a payroll tax and I have to, you know, do all sorts of things and send money to the government and my people are getting poor healthcare. They're probably going to do something strange, like say, well, we're going to employ a doctor on our team that will sit on, you know, the ground floor and which looks to the outside like he's just a HR consultant, but actually he's our in-house doctor. And then they will reduce the packages accordingly, so the payroll taxes will go down, but the employees will get something akin to what they had before. So all sorts of sneaky things are going to start happening, which is how pressured societies with unhelpful governments always react. You know, look what's happening in Zimbabwe, look what's happening in Venezuela, look what's happening in Argentina, what's happening in Turkey. People don't put up with government nonsense. They find ways of working around it. But to come back to your point about the industry, you know that story about the gingerbread man who wants to get across the river? The fox on the bank says, you know what, just jump on my back and we'll swim across and you'll be fine. But then as this fox gets going, he tosses the gingerbread man up onto his nose and scoffs him. That's what my mental model is of what's going on with South African corporates. They somehow think that if they accommodate the democratically elected government, so, you know, I've seen Johnny Broomberg from Discovery make these kinds of comments. He says, listen, we can't fight with them because it's tilting against windmills. You know, he says we've got to accommodate because this is what the democratically elected government wants. The problem with that approach is you just end up like the mining industry has ended up, where you sort of try your best to take the worst bits out of the legislation, but they never come out. And then you end up in an 11th hour court bid to try and find fault with the process or the wording or something. Doesn't work. I think you have to grow a pair and you have to get out there and argue it, because I don't think in truth these companies realize that they're not loved by our government and it's not going to change. So I would really encourage them to be a bit more forthcoming.
Which we will try and work on. One of the things that you fed this diet of inequality and the disparate services that people get depending on how poor or how rich they are. But there are a couple of issues. One is that people tend to forget that private healthcare is a post-tax benefit. So that the state is not losing in its taxation to run hospitals and to provide healthcare. The other thing is that, awful as it may be, as it may sound, in the bad old days, hospitals didn't provide no service to back patients, and some of the services of hospitals was good. And it was good because there wasn't a cadre deployment. There were people who knew how to manage hospitals and who could manage systems. I can't be sure that there was the level of discipline that is necessary, but it was so much more logically done that hospitals tended to operate relatively well, didn't they, obviously. But as we've, particularly the last 10 years of the government, the sense is that there's no decent management, systems aren't followed. I remember once having reading an article where nurses were complaining bitterly about the fact that the bad guys were not being disciplined and were not being fired. Hmm. And it's these things that often, they don't cost anything, but the importance of having them in place is what really makes the difference to a system. The other thing, of course, is being able to manage your hospital finances at hospital level. So you're actually getting what you budget for. You're not getting what the province or the national government thinks it should give you.
Now, I'm told that the rot started in the early 80s when private doctors who used to do a couple of days a week in the public sector and some in the private sector started getting poorly treated, badly paid, and of course it's just accelerated. So in recent times you have to have real nerves of steel to continue to do that kind of public work, which is why so many have migrated to the private sector. And that is unfortunately a very tough thing to fix. But like I said earlier, if the government really wants to try and make this about health outcomes, they would be embracing much more revolutionary tactics, like bringing the private sector back in to operate some big healthcare facilities. We have seen in recent weeks the Gauteng province beginning to throw in the towel on its financial administration, and there was some interesting pushback from Wits University, which shares certain facilities as teaching facilities, saying that they don't agree with the idea of centralized finance management if there's no governance shift as well. Yes, so look, there's an interesting ideological perspective that you just showed there in the beginning of your question, where you said, why is it that healthcare gets elevated this way? Because if you think about it, humans and the way humans value different things in their lives shifts a bit. So I would argue that personal security is about as important an issue as many. And that is why I think it's entirely appropriate that private individuals should make whatever arrangements that they want for private security as a high up. And yet, government seems unconcerned about the idea that people have guards at their businesses, at their schools, at their homes. Healthcare somehow qualifies for a big grand scheme, when in fact I think it shouldn't. I think it should qualify for the biggest, grandest scheme in the public sector. But I don't think government should concern itself with what people do with regard to their private healthcare top-ups, any more than government should worry about what kind of cars people drive or the size of their bedrooms. You know, there are people who put an enormous amount of their private savings into cars because that's how they want to express themselves with the latest, you know, C200 Mercedes. and then they don't eat for the rest of the month. Well, you know, that's for them to decide. And similarly, I don't think it's government's job to decide whether you want to save a large amount of your monthly income so that you can go to, you know, the best gastroenterologist or the best dermatologist in town. You know, leave people alone. There's something wrong with the way that this healthcare sector has been singled out. And I think that debate hasn't really been had. Not that I expect to win it with anyone. I mean, you and I can sit here and have this conversation. Yeah. But I think for the kind of people who go to ANC policy conferences, this is certainly high up on the list of things that they want to get stuck into.
That's why I come back to the point that I think it's ideological, because practically it makes no sense financially. At a startup cost of $500 billion, is the current estimate, to get this going. The old cliche, there are better ways to spend the money. And also the fact that private practitioners, the private healthcare industry, is actually more than prepared to and willing to be a partner to the public sector on the basis of the things they do best, which, from having done them well, would benefit the public sector. Our research has certainly shown that we do a sort of research on the state of people's lives on an annual basis, which we do once a year. We call it the Hope Report. Without fail, every Hope Report we have done, unemployment is the top issue. It's the issue that concerns people year in and year out above all. Then from 2 to 3, it kind of changes a little bit. Sometimes it is health, but it's usually crime. And then educational health reverse. So already health is not at the top. And I don't think people expect the best gastroenterologists in the world. And then interestingly, not directly relevant, but interestingly, and this gives you an idea of how the government sort of changes the shift, the bottom two items are always racism and land. And so it's clearly, from an ideological point of view, what the people want is not what concerns the government. And with a governing party as split as it is, I don't see how something as big as a health system they're planning will do anything but become ultimately a real disaster for everybody.
Look, the best case scenario is that they pass the NHI bill, but it never really gets past being a new fancy name for the funding flows that are existing and going into public healthcare, because they never get to the point where the public facilities, you know, are in any way approach the quality of service required to go to the next stage. Also, I think the ANC lacks the intellectual engine to actually implement anything. As we've seen in recent days, the one crowd has got a treasury policy and then the other department's got another policy, and those don't even match up. So that would be a possibility. In other words, that, you know, the DDG with the ill-fitting suit, who hasn't really thought things through, falls by the wayside, so the policy loses ground. The energetic mountain biker rider from the Klein Karoo, who's supposedly the guy who thought up the financing model, you know, crashes his bicycle. Because there isn't really anything there when you prod and probe and you ask embarrassing questions of them in these conferences where they, you know, brief people on the plan and the rollout and the timetable. I get a feeling they may come a cropper, because, you know, 6 years is a hell of a long time in South African politics. By then we might have, you know, visited all sorts of horrors and had all sorts of reshuffles and personnel changes and so on. But I don't think that's any grounds for complacence. We can't sit here and say, oh, well, these guys are all such, you know, low wattage nincompoops that they're not going to be able to pull this thing off. Because unfortunately, that's, like I said earlier, what the mining industry did. And that's why they got, you know, some sort of half-baked mess there. Much better to take these things on early and try and poke holes in them. So we'll have to wait and see. I mean, I think organizations like the Institute of Race Relations will have an important part in working out where those pressure points are and then trying to mobilize public support around them. And I think you will find a very, very reactive public, whether or not the members of the medical aid Rather the medical aides themselves are prepared to go public, you'll certainly get a big groundswell of individuals who are prepared to help out in one way or another.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think part of the reason we've started in the last year targeting individuals is because it's their needs, it's their aspirations, it's their lives that inform the organisations they belong to, the medical aides they belong to, and we're hoping it's right that one will be able to pressure the people who this potential expenditure mostly affects. Really, one last question is, this has been in the making since about 2011, so it's been this monolith that's been hanging over us forever and a day. But there's something about publishing the bill that has got the medical fraternity saying, Canada, here I come, Australia, here I come. And it's partly rational, it's partly irrational, but I'm not sure how you reassure, if you can reassure these people that the worst is not going to happen.
Yeah, it's very tough. It's very tough. You're right. It was this evil beast has been in, incubation mode for a while. And part of the upset and irritation now is that the new final version didn't take into account anyone's suggestions, including and most importantly perhaps the suggestion that it was entirely inappropriate to make the minister the sole arbiter of everything and to put in place a committee or structure or board or something which is answerable only to him, a very, very bad idea because, you know, there's no sense that it's an independent organ of social or civic society. It's just straightforwardly an instrument then of the government and of the state.
Well, we could find that Fikile Mbalula becomes the next health minister for unexpected reasons.
Exactly, and someone like that who's totally erratic and, you know, appoints friends and mates to the committee who then decide that, you know, interesting or innovative procurement policies and then we'll end up with, you know, billions of rands not paid to service providers and no one who's evidently not could. That is what's going to happen if it's allowed to get to that point. To come back to your medical practitioners and individuals, you know, it is a real concern because I don't think anyone who's a young, bright kid in school at the moment is going to be up for the idea of 7, 8 to 10 years of medical training if they know that the only outcome will be that they will be a state employee like you are in Canada, except that you've got a hostile state rather than a cooperative one. And I say it's a small if there's a window, a trapdoor that allows for private care to continue in this country, and we try to widen that, I think then people must hang in there and see how it goes. I know it's asking a lot, but there are many, many reasons why South Africa remains a great country to live in, and many of us are still optimistic, positive, and patriotic. So I would hope that many people will take a wait-and-see attitude and will hang in there, because I think we will win this battle in the end.
We'll be active while they hang and wait there. Paul Dawn, thank you very much for your time and your insight, and hopefully we'll find you in the battlefield, out in the streets, or wherever we need to make a change.
Yeah, good. I'll do my best.
Thank you.